Hi, my name's Eric. I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of today's Cape Cod Times. Today's date is Monday, April 22nd of 2024. We'll start with the weather, as we always do. Across the Cape and Islands today, you can expect plenty of sun with a high of 54 degrees. Tonight, 40 degrees in the overnight, clear. Tomorrow, Tuesday, mostly sunny, high of 55, low of 41 degrees. And on Wednesday, cloudy and breezy with showers coming in the later afternoon, high of 57, low of 33. Gets chilly on Wednesday night, very cold. Again, 33 degrees, the expected low. On Thursday, plenty of sunshine, high of 51. Again, the low in the overnight, pretty chilly at 35 degrees for this time of year, but that's what it is. And on Friday, sunny. High of 54, low of 40, much more temperate. So we have a middle of the week that may be pretty chilly in the overnight, and a little bit of rain may be expected on Wednesday. But today, tomorrow, sunny days. Get outside, feel it on your face if you can. The sunrise today will be at 5:50 a.m. It will set at 7:30 p.m. We will have 13 hours and 40 minutes of daylight heading to the front of the paper, where the news and, of course, the lottery results are kept. And we read the lottery results because somebody asked for them. If there's something you would like read to people who are blind or print disabled, you can email us at info@audiblelocalledger.org, or you can call us at 508-539-2030, and we'll consider reading it. And if you miss any of the information that we share in our readings, you can always go to audiblelocalledger.org, and in the upper right corner is the archived readings tab. If you click on that, you'll find a week's worth of our newspaper readings, as well as a wide variety of periodicals and literature and shopping guides up there for savings, all of it free for people who are blind or print disabled at audiblelocalledger.org. For the latest lottery results, if you ask for them, you deserve the latest. We go to masslottery.com's website because the Cape Cod Times goes to press too early to give you the latest results. The numbers game for Sunday, April 21st of 2024, in the midday, the drawing numbers were 5276. Again, yesterday's midday drawing numbers game results, 5276. In the evening drawing, the numbers were 8557. Last night's numbers game results for Sunday, April 21st, 8557. Mass cash for Sunday, April 21st, 1, 21, 23, 28, and 32. And Lucky for Life rounds out our results. Sunday, April 21st, the numbers were 23, 24, 31, 33, and 40, with 10, the bonus number. Good luck to all who play. Remember us if you win. Back to the Cape Cod Times e-edition, to the front page, where we have a headline that reads, Hyannis Business Boosting Program Provides Money to Local Shops. And this is reported by Susan Vaughn as a special to the Cape Cod Times. In the past 2 years, 27 small businesses in Hyannis have benefited from $156,000 in grants, which have helped pay for a new freezer, expanded space, an online marketing person, a new sign, all to help them grow and gain an advantage in a competitive market. The Local Business Boost Program began as a partnership between the Hyannis Main Street Business Improvement District and Love Live Local, with support from other local and state money, combined with Gateway Cities grants that are available to Hyannis. Amanda Converse, executive director of Love Live Local that manages the Boost Program, said the requests businesses ask for are not large, but may be improvements they've been putting off while recovering from the pandemic, so they can compete with the big guys, quote unquote. One of the benefits of the Local Business Boost Program, reads the subheading, rather than offering generalized workshops and advice, the Boost Program provides financial support and focuses on implementing the business's needs using local service providers, creating a multiplier effect. In addition to the 27 grants, the program enlisted 44 local service providers, and 44% of the grantee businesses were owned by people of color, 74% were owned by women. "We want to use all the resources on the Cape," Converse said. "The grants can be for interior and exterior improvements or online presence." Converse said the grantees are asked what their priorities are. "It's very flexible based on what they need," she said. "We're able to divest the funds to many different uses to take them to the next level." "The targeted capital infusion has helped the businesses thrive," Converse said, "and as a result, the community thrives. They contribute to the tax base, and they're adding so much unique flavor to the place." Hyannis Main Street businesses get help with marketing. Elizabeth Worthbang, executive director of the Hyannis Main Street Business Improvement District, said the Boost program has been a big help in customizing the needs of the business owner with the help of other Cape businesses, such as establishing a social media website, merchandising, marketing, or window displays. Worthbane said the Boost program has been able to get a variety of grants, including Mass Development's Transformative Development Initiative. "I think we've put together a good reputation," she said, "of helping to get the grants. We would love more funds to get it going and keep it going. Main Street looks better than ever," she said. The Boost grants have helped many new and older Hyannis businesses with a wide range of needs. What Main Street businesses say about the Local Business Boost program is the final subheading. Sarah Frampson is manager of Jewelcraft at 585 Main Street, which is a family business her father, Gary Frampson, started in 1975. The business received a $6,000 grant last year that allowed it to build a new website with a new shopping online feature that Sarah said is very helpful to the business. The store was also able to purchase a light box for photographing jewelry that improved their ability to take detailed pictures quickly. The business also purchased a new modern sign with its new logo, which makes the store more visible in the busy retail district, Sarah Frampson said. Another grant recipient was DaVinto at 539 South Street, an eco and ethically conscious fashion line of sole designer and owner Aiste Zitnikaite. She said the money was very helpful in expanding her business that had been mostly done through online orders. The grant allowed her to create a boutique space to have more products on hand. The contract with a woman to help her with the sewing and to hire someone to do social media and online marketing. Other Main Street businesses that benefited included Foodport International, which bought a more energy-efficient freezer. Pupcake's Pet Boutique got an additional table for larger dogs. Clau's Beauty Salon, that's C-L-A-U, apostrophe S, which was able to expand. Smith Family Popcorn enhanced its exterior. Lance Merritt of 606 Thrift Avenue at 606 Main Street wrote on the Live Love Local website that he's grateful for the money which allowed him to add a dressing room so people wouldn't have to wait so long to try on clothes. "Funding for the Boost program is becoming more of a challenge this year," Converse said. "I've explored funding mechanisms at the state level, but have been told that the state's tightening its belt. Will not be able to fund initiatives like this in the near future. I've also applied for grants with local banks, and we're looking to capitalize the program at $150,000. Also on the front page of today's Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, April 22nd of 2024, the headline reads, "Not just a snack shack. Beachside Jonesen," that's Jones as one word, and then the capital N apostrophe, "represents a lifelong dream," by Rachel Devaney of the Cape Cod Times. Pauline Jones's excitement was palpable as she ambled around Jones'n, her new snack bar and restaurant that she and longtime friend Janine Teixeira will open in May on Craigville Beach. The space is currently filled with unopened boxes, ice cream machines, old commercial cooking equipment like flat iron grills and deep fat fryers, as well as a wood-fired pizza oven, said Jones. About 50 people had gathered at the restaurant's introductory opening Monday for a ribbon-cutting ceremony. For Jones, the opening of Jones'n is bittersweet. It's the first Wampanoag and Cape Verdean-run snack bar to ever launch at that location, said Jones, which is a big deal, she said. But the restaurant was the lifelong dream of her daughter, Junelle Nels Jones Saunders, she said, and that dream was cut short when Saunders died April 15, 2023, at age 29. I know she's looking down and saying, "You did it," said Jones. The whole family came together to make this happen, in her memory. What kind of food will be on the Jonesen menu? Saunders came up with name Jonesen, initially as the name for a food truck, said Jones. Jonesing, quote-unquote, is a popular saying that means a craving for someone or something, she said. Saunders' plan was to cook all her favorite foods on the food truck, including Cape Verdean jagasita, or jag, ribs, Spanish empanadas, fried chicken, lobster rolls, fish and chips, and a variety of pizza, all of which will be on the menu, said Teixeira. Jones said she and her daughter shared a passion for cooking and for food. They'd often tried different recipes together, and they loved cooking Jamaican food, soul food, and traditional Wampanoag recipes. She, meaning Junelle, was never drawn to one type of food, said Jones. She wanted to do it all. According to Jones, Saunders had money saved to open the food truck and was headed to culinary school before she died. This was her vision, said Teixeira. Now we're going to honor that vision. Craigville Beach snack shacks have legacy. Jones and Teixeira submitted an application to the town for the space at 974 Craigville Beach Road and will be heard by the Barnstable Licensing Authority on April 24th, according to Interim Deputy Director of Asset Management and Licensing, Aaron Logan. The building, which is sandwiched between the Barnacle and the Ocean View Motel, has been home to a number of establishments, including the Barnacle 2, and most recently, Bites at Craigville, said Jones. The Barnacle and Barnacle 2 were first opened by Barbara Ross in 1951. Teixeira remembers when her son, Awesome Smith, ran the kitchen at the location when it was under different ownership. Saunders, she said, would often meet him there and cook and help with customers. When Jones and Teixeira were teenagers, said Teixeira, they'd drive down Craigville Beach Road and dreamed of running a restaurant on the beach strip. We've so many memories and connections to this place, said Teixeira, who's Cape Verdean and from the Ponca tribe of Indians of Oklahoma. Throughout her life, Saunders struggled with addiction, said Jones. Before she died, her daughter had been sober for a period of time and had recently emerged from a residential recovery program. Those with addictions struggle, but they still have dreams, said Jones. Sabrina Barros, a friend to Saunders, Jones, and Teixeira, said the snack bar can help Jones through her grief. It's also an inspiration to watch Jones and Teixeira follow through with Saunders' dream, she said. The dedication, the love, and the loyalty that Pauline has for her children is really going to shine through this restaurant, said Barros. Janelle's life was not in vain. She'll be remembered forever. Cheryl Austin, Jones's family member, said there'll be a touch of love in all the food served. This is an amazing tribute to Junelle, said Austin, and we know she'll be in spirit right beside her mother and Janine in that kitchen. In a letter, which Jones shared with the Times, Saunders apologized to her mother for causing her any pain. You never gave up on me. You stood by me, and I know that wasn't easy, said Saunders in the letter. Hopefully I can make you proud. Jones said Saunders died before she could give her the letter. It was on her dresser at the sober house, said Jones. The letter, she said, helped to remind her to continue to dream. We have to represent. We have to keep on trying, she said. This restaurant's part of my heart that beats for my daughter. Shifting gears inside the paper, keeping it local to the Cape and Islands section. Some advice, mosquito outlook for Cape Cod, and ways to lessen the sting, by Eric Williams of the Cape Cod Times. During the colder months on Cape Cod, it's easy to pretend mosquitoes don't exist. Or maybe through some peculiar twist of natural fate, they all just went extinct last fall when the temperatures dropped. Now, wouldn't that be nice? Well, friends, that's not the way it is. We stand on the precipice of warmer days, and the mini vampires are plotting a return, heck-bent on a blood meal that keeps their reproductive operations going. Sure, we humans seem pretty sophisticated with our smartphones and electric cars, but to a mosquito, we're just protein on a stick. Thus, it seems a perfect time to take a look at what mosquito season might hold for the Cape and to find out what we can do to reduce unpleasant interludes with the winged creeps around our homes. To get the latest buzz, we spoke with Gabriel Sikalski, superintendent of the Cape Cod Mosquito Control Project, which is the organization charged with managing mosquito populations in Barnstable County. The question, what does the mosquito forecast look like for Cape Cod this year? Sikalski said predicting how bad the mosquito season might be on Cape Cod's tricky business. An important thing to keep an eye on is how much standing water there is around the Cape, whether it's fresh water or salt water. Unusual amounts of standing water provide more room and opportunity for mosquitoes to reproduce. Right now, we've got a lot of mosquito habitat out there, said Sikalski. Coastal flooding over the winter and spring has brought in salt water that's been slow to dissipate in places, and significant spring rains have added more fresh water to the mix. But this water is still relatively cold. It's not ideal for mosquito nurseries, and a stretch of dry weather could change the equation. It's still early, so it's difficult to judge how things might go, said Sikalski. The question, what's the Mosquito Control Project doing now to manage mosquito populations? Our crews just switched over from water management to larvicide application, said Sikalski. In the cooler months, project crews concentrate on cleaning out waterways and culverts to keep water moving and draining. And then once things heat up, they concentrate on eradicating larvae, a stage of the mosquito life cycle that takes place in water. The question, what's the difference between salt marsh and freshwater mosquitoes? Salt marsh mosquitoes use salt water or brackish water as part of their reproduction cycle, and their habits are different from freshwater mosquitoes. Saltwater mosquitoes bite during the day. They can have a 5-mile range, said Sikalski. They're strong flyers. Mosquitoes that use freshwater as part of their reproduction cycle tend to stay local, said Sikalski, and they're more active at dusk and dawn. Has the Duck Harbor overwash situation in Wellfleet raised mosquito concerns, is the question. The Cape Cod Mosquito Control Project is paying close attention to the Duck Harbor area of Wellfleet, where repeated high tide and storm-fueled overwashes have brought significant amounts of salt water into hard-to-reach interior locations. There's a lot of water in places that we can't physically access, said Sikalski. It's difficult to tell if there are mosquito eggs there. The question, final question, what can I do to reduce mosquitoes around my home? The answer is simple, but you have to stay vigilant. Get rid of standing water around your home. Mosquitoes don't need much water for their eggs to prosper and start a new and irksome generation. Clean your gutters, empty water from pots, kiddie pools and containers in your yard, and check tarps for sneaky puddles. Sikalski said boats, canoes, and kayaks can also be sneaky water collectors if they aren't upturned. And since mosquitoes don't need a whole lot of time to reproduce, it's important to remove standing water after it rains. And if mosquitoes are bugging you around your home this year, Sikalski suggests reaching out to the Cape Cod Mosquito Control Project at 508-775-1510. We are here to help, she said. Eric Williams, when not solving curious Cape Cod mysteries, writes about a variety of ways to enjoy the Cape, the weather, wildlife, and other subjects. You can contact him at ewilliams@capecodonline.com. Also in the Cape and Islands section, there's a beautiful photo of a lovely daffodil, and it reads... headline reads, April's Flower by Steve Heslip. It's prime time for the Cape's most popular flower, the daffodil. A string of sunny, mild days last week coaxed out the blooms. A road trip down the Old Kings Highway, Route 6A, from Barnstable Village to Orleans was like a journey down the yellow brick road, minus the scarecrow Tin Man and little dog Toto. I was feeling a bit cowardly trying to sightsee and drive at the same time, so I could have been a sub in for the lion. Based on my single-source gardening diary data, the daffodil peak season in 2024 is almost 2 weeks earlier than when my record-keeping started almost 30 years ago. This is strictly observational information. Many of the area's annual festivals celebrate the daffodil that will arrive at the end of April. But now mid-month finds the flowers at their brightest. Last year, on April 14th, the temperature approached 80, summer in spring. No matter the timing, the venerable daffodil always shows up to perform. We had a few around our house growing up, but it wasn't until I arrived on Cape that I got the full story. My mother-in-law, a devout daffodil aficionado, gave me my first tutorial on planting. Ignore the directions on the bag of bulbs. Dig a round hole, shake in some bone meal, and loosely clump all the bulbs together. Cover with dirt, start another hole. This planting plan, now 40 years later, still delivers a reliable show. First, the batch by the foundation. Next up, the ones around an old granite boulder in the middle of the yard. It was too much work to move it. And lastly, the flower bed out by the street arrives to finish the show. For the wayward gardener, this is the flowers to invest in. According to the Boston Bulb website, daffodils have been around since 300 BC, originating in the southwest of Europe. The site goes on to tell, in Greek mythology, a story about a man named Narcissus, where the flower got its name. It's a flower that also presents endless photo possibilities. It can provide a wonderful frame to many of the Cape's landmarks, windmills to lighthouses. But I find the closer I look, the more there is to see, which is true of many wonders of the natural world. We've completed all the local news, other than the obituaries, which will be coming up at the half hour. And so we go back to the front page of the Cape Cod Times for today, Monday, April 22nd. The headline reads, "Tariff Threat Comes as Election Looms," by Joey Garrison of USA Today in Washington. During his 3+ years in office, President Joe Biden has reversed former President Donald Trump's actions on immigration, climate, and a long list of other areas. Yet higher tariffs imposed on Chinese imports remain. Not only has Biden left in place Trump's tariffs on some $300 billion of Chinese goods, this week he threatened to more than triple a 7.5% tariff rate on China steel and aluminum to 25%. The move appears as much about the 2024 election as economics, according to trade experts. Biden is sending a signal to the United Steelworkers Union, in an appeal to working-class voters, that he hears their complaints that China holds an unfair advantage in steel competition. And Biden is putting China on notice for what the Biden administration calls China's manufacturing overcapacity, producing more products, including steel, than its demand domestically or the world can absorb, flooding global markets at artificially low prices. Imports of steel from China account for only about 0.6% of total U.S. steel demand, meaning the higher tariffs wouldn't have a dramatic effect on the U.S. steel market. But administration officials have hinted that other potential trade moves could target other sectors. The U.S. isn't taking anything off the table in response to China's overcapacity, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told CNN's Fareed Zakaria recently. In Beijing last week, Yellen said she relayed to Chinese leaders that the U.S. is worried China's weak household consumption and business overinvestment pose a significant risk to workers and businesses in the U.S. and around the world. Yellen pointed to new technologies such as electric vehicles, lithium-ion batteries, and solar panels as other areas that China is overproducing. China is now simply too large for the rest of the world to absorb this enormous capacity, Yellen said, adding that we've seen this story before in regards to steel. Over a decade ago, massive PRC government support led to below-cost Chinese steel that flooded the global market. It decimated industries across the world and in the United States. I've made clear that President Biden and I will not accept that reality again, Yellen said. U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai will conduct an investigation into China's trade practices and shipbuilding following a petition by United Steelworkers alleging that China is pursuing aggressive non-market policies that have allowed it to dominate the global market. Biden, in a speech this week at the United Steelworkers Union's Pittsburgh headquarters, said if the investigation confirms anti-competitive trade practices, then he will advise Thai to triple the tariff rates. Biden's tariff push borrows from Trump's trade playbook. The Republicans' presumptive nominee routinely raised tariffs on Chinese goods during his 4 years in office, igniting a trade war between the world's two largest economies. It's one of the few areas of policy continuity between the Trump administration and Biden in terms of being pretty tough on China in relationship to trade issues, said Alan Carlson, associate professor of government at Cornell University and an expert on Chinese foreign policy. Yet Biden is seeking to differentiate his tariff approach from his predecessors, slamming Trump's campaign tariff proposals as across-the-board tariffs on all imports from all countries that could badly hurt American consumers. Biden said Trump's tariff plan would cost the average American family an average of $1,500 a year. Trump simply doesn't get it, Biden said. I'm not looking for a fight with China. I'm looking for competition, but fair competition. The U.S. steel industry has been rattled by the planned $14.9 billion sale of Pittsburgh-based U.S. Steel, an iconic American brand for more than a century, to Japanese-based Nippon Steel Corp. Biden promised that U.S. Steel will remain American-owned in his remarks in Pittsburgh. That's going to happen, I promise you, Biden said. Ahead of the November election, Biden is looking to improve Democratic performance with white working-class voters who lack college degrees who have increasingly moved to the Republican camp in the Trump era. Although several labor unions, including United Steelworkers, are again backing Biden, many rank-and-file union members have bucked leadership to support Trump in the last two elections. It's an election year, and being tough on China is an issue that plays well, actually, with both Republicans and Democrats, Carlson said. And so, to me, I think this has probably as much, if not more, to do with domestic politics than it does to do with some sort of strategic approach to dealing with China's rise. The price of Chinese steel exports is about 40% lower than the price of U.S. exports. The higher tariffs are designed to provide a more level playing field against China's unfair trade practices and protect American jobs in the steel industry, a Biden administration official said. The higher tariffs would apply to Chinese steel and aluminum imports that aren't subject to a Trump-era 25% tariff still in place on certain steel imports. Because Chinese imports account for less than 1% of U.S. steel, the White House doesn't anticipate an impact on inflation, which has remained stubborn in recent months. U.S. tariffs that come in response to another nation's trade practices are nearing the conclusion of a statutory 4-year review. Any formal action to raise them would follow the review. Amid Americans' lingering concerns about inflation, Biden has sought to make an economic case to working-class voters, who both he and Trump are courting in key Midwest battleground states. On the campaign trail in Pennsylvania last week, Biden compared his Scranton values with Trump's Mar-a-Lago values, casting the former president as an out-of-touch elitist who wants to cut taxes for the rich and didn't deliver on the manufacturing boom that he had promised. And Biden is arguing that he, not Trump, is the president who has held China accountable. Biden said his administration is standing up against China's overcapacity, revitalizing trade partnerships in the South Pacific, and supporting peace and security in the Taiwan Straits. He recounted telling Chinese President Jinping Xi that advanced technologies made in the U.S. won't be sent to China because you'll use it for all the wrong reasons, undermining U.S. national security. For all this tough talk on China, Biden said, it never occurred to my predecessor to do any of that. We're at the midway point in our reading. That's when we move from the news to the obituaries that are listed in that day's Cape Cod Times. Today's date is Monday, April 22nd. There is one obituary. It's of Barbara Joyce of Sandwich, who at the age of 81 passed peacefully on Saturday, April 6th. Barbara is survived by her husband of 55 years, Robert, known as Bob, Joyce, and many who will miss her dearly. Visiting hours will be held at Nickerson Bourne Funeral Home in Sandwich on Sunday, April 28th, from 4 to 7 p.m. Barbara's ashes will be interred at the Massachusetts National Cemetery in Bourne on Monday, April 29th. Friends and family are invited to line up for the procession at 10:15 at Nickerson Bourne Funeral Home in Sandwich and drive together to the cemetery, and a celebration of Barbara's life will follow. Moving back to the news section in the front of the paper, the article reads, "Study Labels Some Produce High Risk," by Julia Gomez. Consumer Reports released a new study on pesticides that found certain produce contains an unhealthy dose of the insecticides and that green beans contained residue of pesticides that have been banned for over a decade. The study found that some fruits and vegetables pose a higher risk than others because of the type of pesticide that was found on them. For example, 4% of green beans tested positive for acephate or methimidophos, a breakdown product of acephate. Farmers and growers have been prohibited from using acephate on their green beans since 2011, while use of methimidophos has been completely banned since 2009. Catherine Roberts, the in-house reporter who wrote the article for Consumer Reports, emphasized to USA Today that Consumer Reports is in no way saying folks should start avoiding the produce aisle altogether. "We are not naysaying fruits and vegetables," Roberts said. "Fruits and vegetables are so good for you." Instead, she said that eating high-risk fruits and vegetables in moderation is fine. "We recommend a half a serving or less a day," said Roberts, and that's still a significant amount. The EPA released a statement that noted the agency tested nearly 30,000 produce samples. 99% of those items showed pesticide residue below the EPA's threshold. In setting a tolerance, EPA determines the amount of residues of the pesticide in or on food that are safe, wrote the EPA in a statement that was sent to USA Today by Jeff Landis, the press officer of the EPA's Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, which means that there is a reasonable certainty that no harm will result from aggregate exposure to the pesticide chemical residue, which includes dietary and other non-occupational exposures, the EPA statement said. What are some high-risk fruits and vegetables? Watermelon and green beans are both high risk because of the pesticides found in them. Consumer Reports found that watermelons contained a pesticide called oxamil. The pesticide oxamil is among those that Consumer Reports experts believe require extra caution because of the potential for serious health risks, the analysis said. According to Consumer Reports, examples of very high-risk fruit and vegetables are bell peppers, blueberries, imported celery, and imported collard greens, and potatoes. Can you wash out pesticides? Well, the answer is no. The produce that was tested, according to Roberts, was washed before it was evaluated. The pesticides can either be taken up in the roots of the plant or they can be absorbed below the skin, said Roberts. So while washing produce before consuming it is an important step, it wouldn't reduce the risk of possibly consuming pesticides. Regardless, Roberts still recommended washing produce for 10 to 15 seconds in cold water before eating it. Who's most at risk from pesticides? Despite residues being found in small amounts of produce, they can still pose huge risks to the people who consume them, especially children or people who are pregnant, Roberts said. She said that not only are some of these pesticides endocrine disruptors, meaning they can affect hormones in one's body, but Roberts said that people whose diets have higher amounts of pesticides could potentially have a higher risk of getting cancer or cardiovascular disease. While the pesticide levels in some of the tested produce may be within the EPA limits, Roberts said that it could be an indication that the EPA's thresholds are too high. Landis said the EPA stands by its comprehensive pesticide assessment and review. EPA's human health risk assessments consider all relevant scientific data on the pesticide, and they're based on the overall risk of a pesticide, taking into consideration comprehensive hazard, dose response, and exposure assessments, the agency said. But the threat extends beyond consumers, Robert said. Farmers, their families, and other agricultural workers who handle the produce are also at a higher risk from contamination. According to a study published by the National Library of Medicine, agricultural workers are more likely to be susceptible to illnesses related to their exposure to toxic chemicals and pesticides. The chemicals they're exposed to daily can negatively affect their physical and neurological health. How to reduce exposure to pesticides as a consumer. The data Consumer Reports collected showed that pesticide-related risk was much lower in organic food than in non-organic food. This is because the Department of Agriculture only allows pesticides that are approved by the National Organic Program to be used on organic produce, Robert said. It's not that organic food has no pesticides, Robert said. The ones that it does have are considered lower risk. Roberts said that Consumer Reports is asking the EPA to ban organophosphates and carbamates, the pesticides that are the biggest drivers of risk in the organization's analysis. These pesticides need to not be used, she said. There's no need for it. Organic growers do it without them all the time. If the EPA proceeded with Consumer Reports' request, it would not be the first time it banned a pesticide. According to the agency, since the start of its pesticide registration review program in 2006, the EPA has canceled some or all uses in nearly 25% of the conventional pesticide cases it has completed work on, when new science points to the need for additional mitigations. The next headline in today's Cape Cod Times of April 22nd, Could Minnesota Be Swing State This Year? By Sam Woodward of the St. Cloud Times in Minneapolis. Minnesota might not be one of the popular sought-after swing states, but its blue hue could turn purple this year. The national polls show a close race in the country's top swing states, but could disaffection and close margins in Minnesota create a second-tier battleground state? Though there's not an official definition, swing states are usually categorized by their extremely small margins of victory. In 2020, seven states were won by less than 3 percentage points: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Despite Joe Biden winning Minnesota's 10 electoral votes by 7 percentage points in 2020, experts are saying it won't be so easy this year. Donald Trump almost won Minnesota in 2016, and he's talked about fighting for it in 2024, political scientist Lawrence Jacobs told the St. Cloud Times. I think it's a battleground state. The 2016 election was just one of a number of elections in Minnesota that came close to flipping. Jacobs, the founder and director of the University of Minnesota's Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, said Minnesota could be a concerning state for Democrats in November. Recent polling from KSTP Survey USA shows that Minnesotans are feeling just as conflicted as the rest of the country. Biden leads Trump by 2 percentage points, with 11% of voters polled saying they'll vote for a third-party candidate. The poll's credibility interval, comparable to a margin of error, is plus or minus 4.9%. And this isn't the only poll to show a close race in Minnesota. The past three polls from KSTP all found Biden leading within the margin of error, all by less than 4 percentage points. These are tight margins, and you can't afford to have tens of thousands of otherwise Democratic voting citizens not showing up and casting a ballot, Jacob said. In Minnesota's presidential primary, almost 46,000 voters used their ballots to cast a protest vote against the president and his support of Israel in its ongoing war. A Republican hasn't won a presidential election in Minnesota since 1972, when President Richard Nixon was reelected. Democrats currently have a trifecta in the state government, but control over the legislative chambers and government seat have gone back and forth over the decades, and Republicans currently represent half of Minnesota's congressional delegation. Biden has campaigned in the Midwest since the start of his reelection campaign, making stops in Minnesota in November and January, and Vice President Kamala Harris made a historic stop at a St. Paul clinic that performs abortions. Trump is yet to campaign in Minnesota, spending numerous days a week making appearances in courtrooms for the various criminal trials against him. The next headline in the Cape Cod Times of April 22nd, Chief Scientist at the WHO sounds alarm on bird flu, by Eduardo Cuevas of the USA Today. The World Health Organization's top scientist said last week that the recent bird flu outbreak is of great concern and vaccine development is not where we need it to be. The virus, which typically infects poultry and wild birds, has spread to mammals, including at least two people in the U.S. in recent years. The new development experts are eyeing is that the virus is now passing from mammal to mammal. Bird flu has a high mortality rate in the hundreds of people who have contacted it, Dr. Jeremy Farrar, chief scientist at the WHO, the United Nations Health Agency, told reporters on Thursday. He expressed concern about recent U.S. bird flu cases among cattle and a Texas dairy worker. The infection has started to become a pandemic among animal species, he said at a press conference. The great concern, of course, is that in doing so, and infecting ducks and chickens, but now increasingly mammals, that virus now evolves and develops the ability to infect humans, he said. And then, critically, the ability to go from human to human transmission. Farrar also said public health officials lack the ability to diagnose the virus. 8 states have experienced bird flu outbreaks in dairy cows, beginning in late March in Texas. The U.S. Department of Agriculture believes migratory birds were the source of the infection, and the virus then spread from herd to herd, experts believe, suggesting there's been transmission among mammals. On April 1st, Texas health officials said a dairy worker was infected with bird flu after close contact with sick cows. Bird flu spreads primarily through contact with infected birds, including dead animals. Human cases are rare. Most occur in people who had unprotected exposure to sick animals. The risk is heightened for people who work with infected poultry or livestock and for veterinarians who treat infected animals. U.S. health officials say the country is ready to ramp up vaccine production if the risk of bird flu rises. The CDC says the risk to public health remains low. It's too early to press the panic button, said Lawrence Gostin, a professor of public health law at Georgetown University. The nightmare scenario, he said, is if the virus makes a genetic leap and begins human-to-human transmission. Given how infectious and deadly the virus is, it would be worse than COVID-19, he said. The Department of Health and Human Services said in a statement that its national pre-pandemic influenza vaccine stockpile program is equipped to respond rapidly to influenza strains as they evolve, including supporting manufacturing capacity to allow for large-scale vaccine production if needed. Editorial note that Karen Weintraub of USA Today contributed to that article. The next headline, report says that infinite scrolling is dangerous for teenagers, by Juan Carlos Castillo of the Asbury Park Press in New Jersey. The American Psychological Association issued a report on Tuesday criticizing how social media is designed in a way that jeopardizes the mental health of young people. More than half of teenagers are reporting symptoms of clinical dependency on social media, and the APA blames design features on the platforms as one of the culprits. Infinite scrolling, visible count of likes and follows, push notifications, and content recommended by AI are some of the common features on social media platforms that hurt teenagers' mental health, the report said. These same features are at the center of the many lawsuits against social media platforms. The infinite scrolling feature was particularly scrutinized by the report, as it makes it harder for younger users to resist the urge to continue scrolling. Youth's developing cortical system makes them less capable of resisting impulses or stopping themselves from behavior that may lead to temporary benefit, despite negative longer-term consequences, the report said. This can lead to adolescents making decisions based on short-term gain, lower appreciation of long-term risk, and interference with focus on tasks that require concentration, it said. On the other hand, push notifications take advantage of younger users' sensitivity to distraction. What's worse is that push notifications force a user to quickly shift tasks, something that requires a higher cognitive ability that people don't develop until early adulthood, interfering with youth's focus. The report, which was made by a panel of 12 scholars, also stressed that brain development starting at ages 10 to 13 until the mid-20s is linked with hypersensitivity to both negative and positive social feedback. Visible counts of a user's followers and likes capitalize on younger users' vulnerability, increasing chances for problematic use of social media. Moreover, likes and follower counts activate neural regions that trigger repetitive behavior, and thus may exert greater influence on youth's attitudes and behavior, the report said. Our next headline in the Cape Cod Times of April 22nd, Supreme Court docket is packed this week. Justices to hear cases on Trump, abortion bans, homeless camps, and more by Dan Morrison in Washington. With cases involving Donald Trump, abortion bans, battling baristas, homeless camps, and scary tattoos, the Supreme Court enters a week packed with arguments that will affect everything from the tumultuous 2024 election to health care, the workplace, and policing. Most notably, the High Court will weigh if and when a former president can claim criminal immunity for acts committed while in office, as Trump, who's currently on trial for allegedly concealing hush money payments to an adult film star, fights three additional indictments over his attempts to overturn the 2020 election and his hoarding of classified documents. But Trump's broad claim that a former president can't face criminal charges without first being impeached by the House of Representatives and convicted in the Senate is just one of several high-stakes cases the nine justices will hear this week. Subheading, banning homeless residents from sleeping outside. Illegal blankets? Justices have been asked to decide if cities can punish people who sleep outdoors. The southern Oregon city of Grants Pass, where winter temperatures fall into the 30s, had cracked down on a homeless encampment by banning tents, blankets, and pillows from public parks. But a federal appeals court ruled that the Constitution's Eighth Amendment, which bars cruel and unusual punishment, doesn't allow criminal charges against people who are sleeping outside when they have nowhere else to go. Gavin Newsom, California's Democratic governor, joined a host of cities in supporting Grants Pass appeal to the High Court, writing that the 2018 decision ties local leaders' hands. Governments need the flexibility to address immediate threats to health and safety in public places, Newsom said. Residents of the Grant Pass homeless camp say the harsh anti-sleeping law was an effort to push its homeless residents into neighboring jurisdictions by punishing them for their existence within city limits. On Tuesday, Starbucks union clashes and tattoos on the visa line. In 2016, El Salvadorian tour guide Luis Asencio Cordero was denied an immigrant visa to be reunited in the U.S. with his wife, Sandra Munoz, an American citizen. After 3 years of trying to find out why, he learned a consular official had suspected Asencio Cordero had a criminal background. The couple surmised that Asencio Cordero's tattoos, one of Our Lady of Guadalupe, another of theatrical masks, suggested membership in the violent MS-13 street gang. They appealed to the American consulate that he had zero criminal links, and they submitted a report from a gang expert that his tattoos had nothing to do with MS-13. But the decision held. Asencio Cordero isn't a gang member and never has been, his lawyer Charles Roth told USA Today. While visa officers have wide latitude in deciding who to admit into the U.S., and they aren't required to say much to justify their denials, the Supreme Court will be asked on Tuesday morning if Asencio Cordero was entitled to more consideration because he's married to an American citizen whose interests are also affected by the visa ruling, and whether the courts have any say at all in visa decisions. Later on Tuesday, latte giant Starbucks, which has been involved in a vicious fight against union organizers at stores across the country, will ask the justices to clarify when the National Labor Relations Board can order employers to rehire workers who say they were unjustly fired. While the case doesn't directly involve Starbucks employees, it's happening during contract negotiations between the $98 billion coffee chain and the Workers United Labor Union, and it's against a backdrop of clashes between organizers and the company. On Wednesday, a post-Roe abortion ban in Idaho. After hearing arguments on immigration and labor law, the Supreme Court will take on a conflict over Idaho's strict abortion ban, which the Biden administration says will harm emergency room patients. Idaho's law, and similar measures in other states, makes it a crime to perform an abortion unless a physician can demonstrate a danger to the mother's life. While the Biden administration says federal law requires emergency rooms to provide stabilizing care, including abortions, if a patient's health is in serious jeopardy. In January, the court allowed the Idaho abortion ban to proceed while the federal government challenges the state's emergency room standard. Abortion has surged to the top of the national agenda since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, as states have moved to either stamp out the procedure or create new protections. On Thursday, Trump and the SEAL Team 6 argument. Can a president get away with murder? Yes, according to Donald Trump, if they're not first impeached by the House of Representatives and found guilty by two-thirds of the Senate. That's the core of the former president and 2024 presumptive Republican nominee's argument that he shouldn't face federal charges for alleged election interference. When an appeals court judge asked in January if this means a president can't face prosecution for selling military secrets, peddling pardons, or ordering Navy SEALs to assassinate a political rival, Trump's attorney replied criminal charges are only possible if the president's first impeached and then convicted in the Senate. I'm struck by how basic questions of presidential power and its limits are underspecified by the courts, said William Howell, a political scientist at the University of Chicago. It's striking that a president, 250 years into our nation's founding, can even make this claim. Trump has warned that anything less than total immunity from prosecution will open the door to an endless cycle of partisan prosecutions of ex-presidents. Our next story, Russia says the U.S. is facing humiliation in the Ukraine. Zelensky welcomes aid and urges the Senate to vote soon, by Guy Falconbridge of Reuters in Moscow. Russia said on Sunday U.S. lawmakers' support for $60.84 billion more in aid for Ukraine showed Washington was wading much deeper into a hybrid war against Moscow that would end in humiliation on a par with the Vietnam or Afghanistan conflicts. President Vladimir Putin's 2022 full-scale invasion of Ukraine has touched off the worst fallout in relations between Russia and the West since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, according to Russian and U.S. diplomats. On Saturday, the House of Representatives passed, with broad bipartisan support, a $95 billion legislative package providing security assistance to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, over bitter objections from some far-right Republicans. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said it was clear that the U.S. wanted Ukraine to fight to the last Ukrainian, including with attacks on Russian sovereign territory and civilians. Washington's deeper and deeper immersion in the hybrid war against Russia will turn into a loud and humiliating fiasco for United States, such as Vietnam and Afghanistan, Zakharova said. Russia, she said, will give an unconditional and resolute response to the U.S. move to get more involved in the Ukraine war. CIA Director William Burns warned last week that without more U.S. military support, Ukraine could lose on the battlefield, but that with support, Kyiv's forces could hold their own this year. The United States has repeatedly ruled out sending its own or other NATO member troops to Ukraine, which is fighting a grinding artillery and drone war with Russia along a heavily fortified 600-mile front. The U.S. lost more than 58,000 military personnel in the 1955-75 Vietnam War, which ended with communist North Vietnam's victory and takeovers of the South, while hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed. In the 2001 to 2021 war in Afghanistan, the U.S. reported 2,459 dead and over 20,000 wounded in the conflict, which ended with the withdrawal of U.S.-led coalition forces and a return to power of the Islamist Taliban movement. The Soviet Union lost 14,453 personnel in the 1979-89 war in Afghanistan. Civilian deaths in both the wars in Afghanistan were vast. The state of the war in Ukraine, Russia now controls about 18% of Ukraine in the east and the south of its neighbor, and it has been incrementally gaining ground since the failure of Kyiv's 2023 counteroffensive to make any serious inroads against Russian troops that are dug in behind minefields that are patrolled by drones and guarded by heavy artillery. Ukraine has for months been begging the U.S. to release more money and weapons to help it fight, though Russian officials have asserted that U.S. aid will not change the ultimate course of the war. Zakharova said that ordinary Ukrainians were being forcibly driven to slaughter as cannon fodder, but that the U.S. was now no longer betting on a Ukrainian victory against Russia. Washington, she said, was hoping Ukraine could hold on until the presidential election in November. The legislative package includes measures that would allow the U.S. to seize billions of dollars worth of Russian assets frozen by sanctions imposed on Moscow. That, said Zakharova, was simply theft, adding that the true beneficiaries of the whole package were U.S. defense companies. The leaders of the West and Ukraine have cast the war in Ukraine as an imperial-style land grab, showing that post-Soviet Russia is one of the top two biggest nation-state threats to global stability alongside China. Putin presents the war as part of a much broader struggle with the U.S., which he says ignored Moscow's interests after the Soviet Union's 1991 breakup, and then plotted to cleave Russia apart and grab its natural resources. The West denies it wants to destroy Russia, which in turn denies that it intends to invade any NATO member state. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday welcomed the passage of the $60 billion in aid for Ukraine by the House of Representatives, but urged Washington to quickly turn the bill into law and proceed with the actual transfer of the weapons, saying long-range arms and air defense missiles were a top priority. In an interview with NBC's Meet the Press, Zelensky said the passage of the bill would send a powerful message to Russia that Washington stands by Kyiv and that it would not be a second Afghanistan. I think this support will really strengthen the armed forces of Ukraine and we will have a chance for victory, Zelensky said through a translator. But he repeatedly urged U.S. lawmakers to take swift action to pass the bill in the Senate. We really need to get this to the final point. We need to get it approved by the Senate so that we get some tangible assistance for the soldiers on the front line as soon as possible, and in another 6 months, Zelensky said. Almost 26 months since the 2022 invasion, Russia is slowly advancing in eastern Ukraine and has ramped up its bombardments of cities and towns behind the front lines amid a slowdown in Western military assistance. The legislation now proceeds to the Democratic Majority Senate, which passed a similar measure more than 2 months ago. Leaders from Democratic President Joe Biden to top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell have been urging embattled Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson to bring it up for a vote. The Senate is set to begin considering the House-passed bill on Tuesday, with some preliminary votes that afternoon. Final passage is expected sometime next week, which would clear the way for Biden to sign it into law. And with that, we've come to the end of our reading of the Cape Cod Times for Monday, April 22nd of 2024. This is your reader, Eric, saying be well, be safe, look after each other. Bye for now.